oil industry. And from the very beginning, the U.S. foreign policy was based on, if we can control the world's oil trade, then we really have control of the world's economy. But in order to do this, we have to prevent other countries from buying oil from countries not controlled by the United States. First by Iran, after it, after the Shah was overthrown. Then you can't let them buy from Russia after 2022. So you had the sanctions against Russia and the destruction of the oil pipeline. Then the sanctions against Venezuela to prevent countries from buying from Venezuela. And now back to Iran to prevent Iran from selling its oil to China. 80% of Iran's oil exports had gone to China. So the whole idea from the beginning was to consolidate the U.S. ability to control oil and thereby to give Trump and the U.S. administration the ability to turn off the lights, to turn off the power, to turn off the electricity to other countries if they did not agree to follow U.S. foreign policy, to maintain sanctions against other oil countries, against Russia, China, also.
Michael Hudson, we're going to continue this conversation. Post online at democracynow.org. Michael Hudson, economist, will link to your article, "The U.S.-Israeli Attack Was to Prevent Peace, Not to Advance It." Michael Hudson, president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I'll be in Savannah, Georgia on Saturday. Check our website at democracynow.org.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
All My Greatest Teacher Showed Me Love, a new mental health program hosted by Zan, providing tips and tools along with music, interviews to lighten and brighten in these uncertain times. Join the community every first and third Wednesday from 10 to 11 a.m. only on KBOO 90.7.
All you need is love to find your way.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregonians will vote on a gas tax increase in May. State leaders join a summit to shape the future of Oregon's grazing lands. And, in international news, Israel attacks Hezbollah, widening the scope of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. I'm Josh Salem. Oregonians will vote in May on whether to raise gas and payroll taxes to help fund transportation projects and road repair. Governor Tina Kotek signed the bill on Monday afternoon. It marks the end of a long political battle between state Democrats and Republicans. The tax increases were passed in 2025 as part of the state transportation package. The per-gallon gas tax would go up 6 cents, and the state payroll tax for public transit would increase by 0.1. As well, title and registration fees would go up. All of these would help fund road and bridge maintenance across the state. Republicans got enough signatures to refer the tax increase to the ballot in November. Democrats in the state legislature passed a law to move that to May, in the primary election, when fewer voters typically cast a ballot. Both Democrats and Republicans expect Oregon voters to reject the tax increase. Democrats say that knowing that in May instead of November means they can better plan on how to fund the Department of Transportation in the meantime. Republicans say that moving the vote's timing is a political move to keep an unpopular measure off the same ballot as Governor Kotek and other state Democrats who are running for re-election. Landowners, state agencies, and conservation groups will come together to discuss the future of Oregon's grazing lands this month at the Northeast Rangeland Summit. Organizers say the summit will give an opportunity for stakeholders to share lessons and strategize about meeting the industry's challenges, including invasive species management, drought, and mentoring the next generation of ranchers. Isabel Charlet reports.
A summit in Northeast Oregon this month will bring together landowners, state agencies, and conservation groups to talk about the future of the state's vast grazing lands. Marcy Schrader is with Wallawa Resources, the group that is organizing the summit around the theme Deep Roots and Fresh Faces. She says it's a chance for stakeholders to learn from each other and strategize about how to contend with many challenges facing modern ranching, like invasive species, drought, and wildfire.
Conservation and agriculture are not opposing forces. Through collaboration, technical support, locally driven solutions, ranchers are leading meaningful efforts to care for the land in ways that really do benefit entire communities.
Schrader adds the summit will highlight new grazing technologies, including virtual fencing, which uses GPS-enabled collars to track and control where cows roam. She says the tool could save ranchers money and would cut down on physical fencing, benefiting wildlife. The second annual Northeast Rangeland Summit will be on March 18th in LeGrand. Schrader says the summit will also focus on supporting the next generation of ranchers. She says the average age for ranchers across the country is 65, and it is getting harder to replace them once they retire.
A lot of young people are wanting to get into ranching that may not have the experience within their own families, so they're seeking those mentoring opportunities.
About 15 million acres are used for grazing cattle in Oregon, mostly in the southern and eastern parts of the state. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The U.S. and Israel's war on Iran has grown in scope to include attacks on Hezbollah in Lebanon. Early Monday, Hezbollah launched rockets and drones into northern Israel. More than 150 people were wounded. Israel retaliated with a wave of airstrikes that killed 52 people in Lebanon, including a Palestinian militant and a Hezbollah intelligence official. Israel sent troops into southern Lebanon yesterday and ordered residents of more than 80 villages to evacuate. Hezbollah is an Iran-backed Lebanese Shiite militant group and political party formed in the 1980s. It has been designated as a terrorist organization by over 60 countries. Israel launched a ground invasion of Lebanon in October of 2024 during its last war with Hezbollah. It withdrew from most of southern Lebanon after a U.S.-brokered ceasefire halted the fighting, but has continued to occupy 5 points on the Lebanese side of the border since then. After the ceasefire, Israel continued to carry out nearly daily strikes, primarily in southern Lebanon, saying that Hezbollah has been trying to rebuild its forces in the area. A senior Hezbollah official said that after more than a year of abiding by a ceasefire, the group's patience has ended, leaving it with no option, quote, but to return to resistance and fight an open war with Israel. Mohammed Komadi said, quote, the Zionist enemy wanted an open war, which it has not stopped since the ceasefire agreement, so let it be an open war, end quote. The Lebanese government says it has disarmed Hezbollah south of the Litani River, along the border with Israel, and that Lebanese troops are in full control of the area between the river and the Israeli border. The Israeli military says it has sent additional troops into southern Lebanon, and that it took new positions on several strategic points close to the border. Meanwhile, the Lebanese army is evacuating some of its positions along the border. The UN peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, known as UNIFIL, says its peacekeepers observed Israeli forces crossing into Lebanon in several areas yesterday morning. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management is set to roll back 2024 bonding requirements meant to protect taxpayers from the cost of cleaning up abandoned oil and gas sites. A new analysis by Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship estimates the move would cost American taxpayers $753.5 billion. Eric Galatis has the details.
Taxpayers in Colorado and across the U.S. could be on the hook for over $750 billion if the Trump administration moves forward with plans to roll back bonding requirements for oil and gas companies operating on public lands, according to a new analysis. The U.S. Bureau of Land Management requires companies to post bonds to ensure that well sites are properly plugged after drilling is complete. David Jenkins with Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship says if bonding costs drop back to paltry 1960 levels, bad actors will continue to skip town and leave messes for taxpayers to clean up.
You know, if they promise to clean up as a condition of the permit, then we've got to hold them to that. And anyone saying we shouldn't hold them to that is just turning their back on taxpayers.
There are currently some 130,000 abandoned oil and gas wells on public lands. That's due in part to previous bonding levels as low as $1,700. The actual cost of cleanup is over $70,000. The Trump administration believes rolling back regulations on fossil fuel companies, including bonding requirements, is necessary to unleash American energy and achieve its goal of energy dominance. In 2024, the BLM updated bonding requirements for the first time in 60 years to bring them in line with cleanup costs and protect taxpayers. Jenkins notes many extraction companies incorporate restoration plans in their business model, but he says too many producers, after they get the oil and gas they want, go on to sell their permits to companies that exist only for the purpose of going bankrupt.
By structuring the shell game, it's clear the intent is to rob taxpayers. It's not accidental. It's not, oops, we forgot to do this. It's an intentional scheme.
Jenkins notes the BLM's 2024 rules came in response to support from the vast majority of Western voters across party lines for increasing bonding requirements.
Why would anyone who is even remotely fiscally conservative think that adding to the national debt and saddling the American taxpayer with almost $1 trillion in cleanup costs is anything but a fiscal nightmare?
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
The American Cancer Society estimates that more than 26,000 Oregon residents will be diagnosed with cancer in 2026. Cancer research is facing funding cuts from the Trump administration, but scientists remain optimistic about advances being made in fighting the disease. Freda Ross has more.
Cancer survival rates are at a historic high, but medical professionals are concerned about potential cuts to research proposed by the Trump administration. CEO of the Cancer Research Institute, Dr. Alicia Joe, says funding has already been cut in some areas.
Research that are particularly focused on disparities and diversity in healthcare and in science, as well as on specific areas of investigation, like we've seen, unfortunately, a decrease in funding for work that involves cancer vaccines.
Members of Congress have successfully fought back against some funding cuts to the National Institutes of Health, but Joe says uncertainty has forced some labs to cut staff and stop research projects. Young scientists are also paying close attention to the debate over funding. Joe says some are considering switching careers or studying outside of the United States.
That, unfortunately, would be a sort of irreparable, you can't control that kind of a change. And so we're not going to feel the effect of that tomorrow, but we will feel the effect of that in 10 years or 15 years when suddenly the most innovative science is no longer happening at U.S.-based institutions.
Joe says even with the uncertainty in the field, advances are being made.
We're on the cusp of a lot of great breakthroughs. For the first time this year, we've actually seen cancer mortality survival rates go to 70%. So we're seeing actually cancer is becoming truly a problem that we know we can actually solve. It's no longer a death sentence.
I'm Freda Ross.
Hegseth and Trump predict war with Iran will stretch on for several weeks and refuse to rule out sending out ground troops. Law enforcement agents are discouraging assumptions that the airstrikes were the motive in a Texas mass shooting. And energy prices react to the conflict. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We didn't start this war, but under President Trump, we are finishing it. Their war on Americans has become our retribution against their Ayatollah and his death cult.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is shifting course to say clearly the U.S. and Israeli airstrikes on Iran that started Saturday are intended for regime change. The White House is now refusing to rule out sending ground troops. President Donald Trump says the war will continue for another 4 to 5 weeks and accuses the Islamic Republic of killing thousands of Americans, probably referring to terrorist attacks and Iranian-designed roadside bombs that hit soldiers in Iraq. 6 U.S. service members have died so far. Trump and the Pentagon say they expect more. The attacks came just after a mediator from Oman said, quote, a deal was at hand between the U.S. and Iran on the nation's nuclear program. During a series of airstrikes last year, Trump said that nuclear program had been obliterated, though reports then and now contradict that. For his part, Secretary of State Marco Rubio insists the objective is not regime change, but to prevent Iran from inflicting global terror with nuclear weapons.
Iran, in about a year or a year and a half, would cross the line of immunity, meaning they would have so many short-range missiles, so many drones, that no one could do anything about it because they could hold the whole world hostage. Look at the damage they're doing now. And this is a weakened Iran. Imagine a year from now.
Danny Donen is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He says Iran's region-wide counterattacks against almost a dozen countries show why the joint U.S.-Israeli operation was necessary.
Ballistic missiles fired in desperation, a regime striking widely as it brought to its knees. Now, imagine that same regime with a nuclear capability. That is not a risk we tolerate. That is a reality we will not allow.
Iran's leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, was killed in the initial strikes, and subsequent targets have included offices and barracks used by the hated agencies in charge of internal repression. They gunned down an estimated 20,000 protesters and ordinary civilians last month. However, the administration's top choices to lead a post-Khamenei Iran were also killed in the airstrikes. It's not clear who could fill a power vacuum there. Meanwhile, 53-year-old Ndiaga Diagne opened fire on a series of bars in Austin, Texas, killing 2 and injuring 14 others before being shot dead by police. Diagne was wearing a sweatshirt saying, quote, property of Allah, and a shirt underneath with the Iranian flag. But Alex Duran with the FBI's San Antonio office discouraged people from leaping to conclusions about the motive.
We want to make sure that we have our facts 100% correct, or at least we've tracked down every possible lead that we can, because that's what we owe to the victims. That's what you guys want answers for. More importantly, we owe that to the victims and their families to be right.
Global energy prices are up in response to the war. Crude oil rose more than 10% immediately after the attacks before settling. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the impact of data centers on Oregon waterways. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy, with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy, with a high of 52. Today in history, in 1986, Australia becomes fully independent from the United Kingdom through the Australia Act of 1986. The quote of the day is from French essayist Émile Chartier, who wrote, "The anomaly of war is that the best men get themselves killed, while crafty men find their chance to govern in a manner contrary to justice." Marks 150 years since the Battle of Little Bighorn, and Native tribes are pushing back against the Trump administration's efforts to remove national park signage about the indigenous experience of the battle. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn, which is also called the Battle of the Greasy Grass or Custer's Last Stand. Ahead of events planned in late June near Crow Agency, Montana, are reports that the National Park Service is removing signs sharing the Native perspective on the battle. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
In late January, the Washington Post reported that President Trump ordered the removal of signage through his so-called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History directive, which pushes an ideology that the U.S. has a, quote, unmatched record of advancing liberty, prosperity, and human flourishing. The Battle of Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument is on the list of sites. Wallace Baircham is chairman for the Northern Cheyenne Cultural Commission. Along with the Lakota Sioux and Arapaho, his tribe defeated Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and the 7th Cavalry Regiment in 1876. Baircham says federal officials and tribes need to discuss any changes per their government-to-government relationship.
We're still finding out what exactly changes that they're going to make. And in Northern Cheyenne, it was a victory for us there. And our stories there, I mean, how can you change that story? You know, there's no way you can do that, you know. And what exactly are they trying to change?
The Northern Cheyenne Tribe unanimously approved a resolution last month to prevent any changes to markers, signage, and monuments that recognize Native people at Little Bighorn, a direct challenge to the Trump administration. Meanwhile, an email from the U.S. Secretary of the Interior's office denies any signage has been taken down at the battlefield monument. It says parks are complying through an ongoing review process with subject matter experts, tribal partners, and park leadership. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
An Alaska doctor has documented the first case of a rare and potentially risky infection from contact with a brown bear. The infection is known as seal finger, and people typically get it handling seals, especially during hunting and processing. But in 2024, Dr. Benjamin Wesley diagnosed it in a man who had cut his hand skinning a brown bear hunted on the Alaska Peninsula. He had 3 days of redness and painful swelling that did not resolve with standard antibiotics. Wesley says early tests did not find anything definitive, so he sent a tissue sample to a lab for more comprehensive analysis.
What was particularly shocking about this patient was he had a finger infection after skinning a brown bear that was not responding properly to antibiotics. So I sent special PCR tests, but I did not expect this bacteria.
Seal finger is not uncommon in Alaska and circumpolar regions, but Wesley says this is only the second time this potentially more serious strain of the infection has been identified in the state. He diagnosed the first case, too, in a patient whose finger infection had spread to his hip.
So when the report came back, I was shocked because the first case was my own patient 10 years prior, and now it was the exact same bacteria for the second time in Alaska, but from a brown bear exposure, not from a seal exposure.
The infection is only a risk through direct or indirect animal contact. Other cases outside the state have been tied to a polar bear and a domestic cat. Scientists do not know if those animals caused seal finger because they'd had contact with a seal or through other means. In this case, the patient was treated at first with the wrong type of antibiotics used for bacterial infections. That allowed the infection to worsen and cause dead tissue, a damaged tendon, and a bone infection. He recovered but still has lingering finger stiffness. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Carbon dioxide levels are at their highest in human history, and they are warming the Earth dangerously fast. To explain more on how carbon dioxide traps heat, it's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. There is more carbon dioxide in our atmosphere now than at any time in at least 800,000 years. Much of this additional carbon dioxide, or CO2, was emitted by people burning fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas. And as it accumulates in the atmosphere, that carbon dioxide is warming the Earth dangerously fast. Scientists have known since the 1800s that CO2 traps heat. As sunlight hits the Earth, it warms the planet. Some of that heat radiates back into space, but some is also trapped by CO2 in the atmosphere, like a blanket wrapped around the planet. It's what's called the greenhouse effect. This warmth allows life on Earth to exist, but as CO2 levels rise, too much heat is trapped, and the Earth gets hotter and hotter. That makes extreme weather like hurricanes, droughts, and heat waves more destructive. And as people burn more fossil fuels, atmospheric CO2 levels keep rising at a breakneck pace. In the 1950s, the atmosphere had about 320 parts per million of CO2. Today, it has around 430. So to slow global warming, it's critical to reduce the use of fossil fuels as soon as possible. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Coming up on March 15th, the Portland Performing Arts Academy, FAME, will put on its yearly gala, raising funds for their performing arts school, which serves adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities. KBOO's Carrie Stewart Langill stopped by Fame's new program space to learn more.
The Fame Academy in Portland, spelled P-H-A-M-E, is a nonprofit organization that provides arts education and performance opportunities to adults with intellectual disabilities. The school was founded in 1984 as an artistic complement to the Special Olympics and its focus on athletics. FAME teaches classes on acting, comedy, dance, and visual arts. Their improv troupe performs a monthly showcase at Portland Comedy Theater, and on March 15th, FAME students will perform at the organization's annual fundraising gala at Avenue Portland in the Lloyd Event District. Details on all FAME performances are available online at famepdx.org. Carrie Siapish joined FAME as executive director last September, around the same time the Academy was moving into a new campus in Southeast Portland, which they call The Robin. Earlier this month, Carrie gave me a tour and introduced me to some of FAME's proudly neurodivergent students.
We have been in this building space now since about September 15th, and so we had about 2 weeks to get all of our students and all of our supplies and our classroom spaces from the church that we've been in for almost 20 years over into this space. We did it all in 2 weeks. We had a big student night about a week before classes started, and we started here on September 29th for our fall term.
I am Xander Cloud. I have been doing comedy troupe for, I think, a little over a year. But I also do rock ensemble, and I'm also in their small group as well. I really like FAME, and it really means a lot to me because it's been my place of arts and performing ever since I graduated from high school. I feel really like I'm giving a chance of taking performances and pushing myself to make it to that next level.
On my very first day, which was the first day of classes, so nobody had even been in the building yet. I came in and we already had a couple of men playing cards over at the table over here and a couple of people kind of chit-chatting over here, and there were backpacks everywhere.
I'm Caitlin. I've been doing a comedy troupe, lots of dance classes, drumming, and so many others. I've been here for 2 years, so I've done a lot now. I like being here at FAME because I can be myself, and at home I've always been a little goofy and funny, so I'm glad to be a part of comedy troupe because our coach Nick, he actually wanted me to be a part of comedy troupe. He believed in me after I was in his theater class, and he wanted me to audition, and here I am now.
Today is Thursday, so we'll have comedy troupe that's happening in that room kind of up there where we first went in. We have mixed media, dance evolution, improv theater. So we do crafting, we do painting, we do watercolor and collage. Visual arts are still pretty new to FAME, primarily a performing arts organization, but also now we're doing more holistic artwork. So that happens over here. We have students from one of the universities who work with our students as occupational therapists. So they can do things like help with job applications or social situations between students. Or if two students are having a relationship, they'll help them talk through any of the kind of challenges that they're dealing with then too.
I'm JT. I am part of comedy troupe. We're gonna do a couple skits and stuff. But I'm also part of rock ensemble, so I am going to be singing Fly Like an Eagle and the Space Jam song. I like FAME because they're very inclusive and stuff, and since I've been part of it for a while now, for like 9 years or so, it feels like a second family.
Actually, this is really not very glamorous, but it's also one of the coolest things is that our Lyft drivers can actually drive right up to the front door right here.
So why is it called The Robin?
That's a great question. So it's called The Robin because the person who helped us get into this building, one of our major donors, really loves birds, and it was her suggestion, so we named it that way in her honor.
That was KBOO's Carrie Stewart Langill reporting on the FAME, spelled P-H-A-M-E, Performing Arts Academy. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 3rd, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Rachel Garcia, myself, Josh Salem, and Carrie Stewart-Langle. Their producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Freda Ross, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth. We'll be speaking with John DeVoe from Water Watch of Oregon about data centers and how they impact waterways.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
HR 655, a bill currently under consideration, would transfer 150 acres of federal public land from the Mount Hood National Forest to the city of the Dalles, where Google operates a data center